This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about leadership and management with government executives and thought leaders who are truly changing the way government does business. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and leadership fellow at the IBM Center with the Business of Government. What is the technology strategy for the U.S. Department of the Air Force? How is the U.S. Air Force leveraging emerging technology such as AI to transform how it does IT? And what is the U.S. Department of the Air Force's zero trust strategy? I'll explore these questions and so much more with my very special guest, Jason Bonci, Chief Technology Officer within the U.S. Department of the Air Force. Jay, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Michael.
I'd like to kick off my conversation providing our audience with some context. I was hoping you could describe for me the mission of your office and how it supports the overall mission of the Department of the Air Force.
Great. So the Office of the CTO exists under the umbrella of the Office of the CIO. And federal CIOs have this sort of interesting place in the military where we have Title 44 authority over IT. And what this means is we are accountable to IT outcomes. And so this gives us this broad purview, whether or not it is governing the finance, whether or not it is taking a look at the security or compliance with various federal statutes. And so we work in partnership with the traditional military cyber responsibilities, the traditional acquisition authorities to deliver IT capabilities. And so within those CIO authorities for delivery, we're really focused in on enterprise IT as a kind of a core enabler for the department. My job as the CTO is to be in very much the technical narrator of the enterprise. And so it's my job to pull together where we're going, where we need to inform and assist our delivery partners in seeing the broader context of what we actually need to deliver, as well as be the kind of technical arbiter of last resort for sort of conflicts between different organizations. And so I support the full scope of Title 44 authorities, but I also work very closely with the folks who are doing the actual delivery. And so I see myself very much as the technical conduit between the folks who are doing the delivery and leadership all the way up through Ms. Goodwine and Secretary Kendall. And so it's my job to tell that consistent story about where we're going, what we actually need to get done, and then be a set of helping hands when we hit roadblocks.
Jay, could you tell us what a day in the life or a week in the life of the CTO for the Air Force is like?
So the principal output of my office, which is relatively small, so I have got myself, a deputy, and some support contractors, as well as support from other folks within the larger SAP-CN. That's the secretariat level CIO office. A day in the life is really largely around developing content and helping to hold meetings to be that technical arbiter. So we do a lot of work in strategic communications and in structuring technical ideas so that people can understand where we're going. And this is oftentimes, 4-hour blocks where we are, for instance, working through the network strategy. So a huge chunk of my week last week was saying, all right, let's get the words in place that describe where we're going for an overall network strategy. And then we can start to link that towards our zero trust efforts to where we're going with CIPRNet, right? And where, right now we're doing budget certification and budget processes we need to for our work with DoD CIO, talk about how we're coming together for the next generation of our secure networks. And so it is us telling the story about where we think we should be going, the types of technologies we need to be going after, and the changes to delivery models that we think will build a better secure network in the future. And so it's developing that content and then doing the education for folks about what that content means and helping them contextualize it to the various efforts. So I've got a couple of specific areas, ICAM, some of our base infrastructure modernizations, so our next generation networking pieces, you know, some of the zero trust elements that I spend more time on day to day. But largely it is it's content building, right? It is being that technically informed strategic communications author as we pull together the messaging coming out of the office of CIO.
With the speed of technology and what you're doing at Air Force, getting that messaging right and making it digestible, it's got to be sort of a challenging experience to do that. I was wondering, maybe what are some of the challenges you're facing in fulfilling the leadership role you're in right now?
The challenges are largely just the sheer scale of the Air Force, right? And trying to figure out how you can get a message about where we are going. There's such incredible demand for change and progress. And this is one of the wonderful things about the Air Force in particular, right? The one thing I heard, it might've been from a book, I'm not exactly sure the source, but there is this concept that the Air Force is culturally built on top of wielding technology for military purposes, right? Flight wasn't a thing, right? And you know, conversely now, space wasn't a thing, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, right? When we initially put together these structures. And so as we have matured and as we have built a culture that is around adapting and iterating over technology, our culture is a reflection of that. And the progress demanded by those cultural implications and the way that we even as a service, the way that we argue about ideas and the way that we argue about technology are unique because of that cultural underpinning. And it is difficult to make sure that you are talking to the whole Air Force. It's difficult that to understand the perspective of so many different types of personas. So we have, you know, our cyber operators who key in on certain things. We have our intelligence community that finds certain things important. We have our budgetary folks and our, you know, our Pentagon leadership that also have different incentives. And, you know, one of the things for me not being in the Pentagon is I try to be out of the Pentagon bubble. And that also allows me to not be as responsive to Pentagon demands for time or get, you know, tacked on to various meetings just to fill a seat, and allows me to really focus on the content. But what that means is I try to have a larger perspective around what the field needs. And that means making sure that I maintain those contacts with people who are doing the delivery or who are in our combat match comms or folks who are in our acquisition department to get that kind of day-to-day delivery challenges. So you can take those snippets, right? So I think the joke is the plural of anecdote isn't data, but it does allow you to pull together a sense of what is going on to be able to tell that narrative either for improvement, for communication, or to be able to give leadership the opportunity to lead and change some of the delivery environment. So the scope is unlike anything I've ever dealt with before. It's been a fabulous challenge. And it is really kind of the defining reason for why I kind of took this position, right? This is the thing that I came here to learn and the thing that I came here to improve at.
Jay, what has surprised you most since taking over this current role?
The thing that really has struck me as surprising. So first off, the number of things the Air Force does is just mind-blowing. There was a time where, you know, in my first maybe year and a half, and even to this day, every week I learned a new thing the Air Force did, right? Whether or not, you know, to say like, oh, you know, we have a fuel management division that has to pre-position fuel. Like, oh, okay, you know, obviously that makes sense. Like, oh, we have these daycare centers. Okay. We have a whole medical arm. Oh, right. Obviously. Oh, we have casinos that we run over in Europe as a part of MWR. We're like, oh, okay. We run bowling alleys. Oh, okay. Right. And so just the, you know, the sheer scale and scope from everything from operations to logistics to MWR to personnel to finance to the places where we're the executive agent for other DoD functions and thus have some responsibility. That's been one of the biggest surprises. One of the things that I've learned about working in government and large bureaucracies is the inhibitor to progress is how fast an idea can percolate through a bureaucracy. And that's been a key insight for what it means to focus our time and how much we need to spend in strategic communications. Things tend to gain momentum and gain traction when people are talking about them. And it is almost this internal marketing and buzz that you have to deliver, because things suddenly start to feel important. They start to get prioritization on people's time. And there is this broad economy of effort that exists within the department. And all ideas are competing for hours in the day and senior leader attention. And so how you manage those expectations for delivery in these large organizations are key to the success of any project. And I didn't quite understand that as being the limiting factor. There are, of course, other limiting factors, budget, skill gaps, whenever you're talking about something that's relatively technically sophisticated. But principally, if things can get attention, and things have the right story, things can get done. And that has been the core revelation of understanding both the heartbeat and pace of the building and the heartbeat and pace of the field as things come out for delivery.
You know, Jay, when I think about your journey, as you called it, I was wondering, what have you learned or how do you lead? I want to talk about leadership and just to get a better sense of your own personal leadership style, but perhaps even underscore and describe some of the leadership principles you follow. So what makes an effective leader, Jay, in your mind, and how do you lead?
For me, the core tenet of leadership in the technical space is accessibility. And this means being a resource to the people who are actually doing the delivering. And this, it takes a lot of careful and considered effort to find the most effective communication to people to reduce the power distance in these large hierarchies, right? So what I said before was the progress is inhibited by the speed of how fast ideas transmit inside of a bureaucracy. And you can see this in all sorts of subtle ways, right? So if there's a problem, what happens is, your GS-13 will tell their boss who's a 14 or a 15, they'll prepare a brief, they'll pre-brief their boss. The message gets manicured and then eventually comes up to the senior leader level. And then, it could get briefed to you for some kind of decision, and then you lose the context and nuance of it. And so for me to be an effective communicator, I need to be the straight pipeline as much as possible between delivery and leadership. And to do that, you have to reduce that core power distance, right? So this title comes as a one-star equivalent. And if you were to really embrace the military hierarchy of it, I wouldn't get the signal through the noise of what's actually going on. And so for me to be an effective resource in terms of writing policy or crafting strategy or, just having people who can reach out and say, hey, this thing that's happening is kind of messed up. Can you take a look at it? And to be there and to be able to pick up the phone and to be available requires a really active focus in that accessibility. And it could be kind of some subtle things about how, you talk to people on a first name basis. You understand, you answer their emails, you appear, you don't wear a tie in meetings, you appear to be a more accessible person so that information gets up to leadership so that correct decisions can be made faster and to come back down. And that has been the kind of, it's important to me to be a servant leader and in a deeply hierarchical department, like the military is. All federal service is deeply hierarchical, but the military a little bit extra. And so trying to make sure that you can short circuit some of that hierarchy by being personally connected to people has been what I think is been a kind of a core principle of my leadership and is what's made me successful in this position.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about where you're coming from and the technology, the speed in which it's changing and developing and evolving, you almost need that ability to actually use, to actually get the effectiveness you need out of these tools.
Yeah. And that relevance too is incredibly important, right? And so just being able to have a working knowledge of cloud concepts and security concepts and identity concepts, right? There is so much, you know, I'm thankful to come into this position with two decades of industry experience for how services get delivered and secured and to understand the landscape of those technology providers who are kind of paving the path to the future. So it is so important for the Pentagon to have those outside inside experts, folks who have been outside for so long, but then can be kind of like trusted as being in the tribe to be able to, so that people feel like, oh, you know, I'm not an outsider who's trying to push a product or has these outside ideas, but a person who's really trying to solve problems within the system and bring all of that technology experience to bear and to be able to, part of actually one of the other core challenges now that I'm thinking about it is I do a lot of work with industry to help them to understand the internal thought process of the department. Now, obviously, we do this within the moral and ethical bounds of, you know, all of our acquisition pieces. But to be able to give everybody a solid talk track to say, when we say that we are thinking about base infrastructure modernization or identity, these are the things that are important to us. These are the types of core problems we're trying to solve. This is the language that we are using, and not to let a language barrier from the government to industry bubble cause weird outcomes, and try to wire in as much of that internal thinking back and forth between industry and government as much as possible. So again, it is about that accessibility. It's about being knowledgeable about the underlying technology trends and being as crisp and as effective a communicator as possible.
What is the technology strategy for the U.S. Department of the Air Force? We'll explore this question and so much more when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.
To support government financial performance and accountability, financial systems must meet certain standards, and relying on outdated financial systems inhibits progress. ERP vendors are encouraging clients to move to the cloud and consider new technologies such as robotic process automation, blockchain, and AI to enhance financial productivity. Download the IBM Center Report, Financial Management for the Future, at businessofgovernment.org to learn why and how government can evolve to meet the demands of a digital world. The Ebola crisis in West Africa from 2014 to 2016 was an epidemic that put emphasis on global capacity to respond to international disasters. How can government better assess the needs of those affected and help them? The IBM Center report, Responding to Global Health Crisis, by Professor Jennifer Widner, breaks down the U.S. response to the Ebola crisis and provides insights on lessons learned that may aid the government responses in the future. Download your free copy, Responding to Global Health Crisis, at businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jay Bonci, Chief Technology Officer within the U.S. Department of the Air Force. I'm wondering, Jay, as you kind of touched on this earlier in our conversation, but I was hoping maybe you could delve a little deeper into the strategic technology vision of the Air Force that you see, the narratives that you're talking about and how you're communicating those, and maybe highlight for us maybe some of your key strategic priorities of late.
So what I would say is the broad arc of technology for the Air Force, we can kind of place this into two broad buckets, right? So there is the airframe side of the world, right? The kind of hardware basis of the Air Force. And the goal there is to continually develop and deliver these major platform capabilities that we can do our warfighting on. And you'll see a lot of that stuff out in the press and the things that we're trying to release there. And my job in the Office of the CIO is to support those things. So whether or not it is the F-35 or the upcoming, you know, E-7 AWACS replacement or our ISR ecosystem, we are providing this baseline on which all capabilities are delivered, right? So there's no such thing as enterprise IT or warfighting IT. Warfighting is done on enterprise IT. So that's the kind of first strategic narrative that we're talking about. If you look at a couple of things, if you look at the broad arc of technology, it's only getting more complicated and our operators are not getting any older. And so we have to jam more and more and more complexity and more institutional knowledge into an operator for them to be able to even have a technician level understanding of what's going on. And so for us, this means that we need to go more and more towards a strong enterprise-led set of IT delivery. And this is really, really challenging. The product and service management necessary to centralize, I know not everybody loves that word, but it's effectively what you're doing, to find that set of commoditized requirements is incredibly hard. In fact, enterprise IT is unlike unlike many other deliverables and the way that we think about capability delivery in the military. Oftentimes you have this sense of like, oh, we have a requirement, whether or not it's this, you know, tactical requirement or this, you know, we need an air platform to fly this fast and use as much fuel and to be able to maneuver this amount, right? If you take that thinking, you can't deliver enterprise IT that way, because enterprise IT is the sum commoditization of all of your other mission sets. And so your customer management, your strategic communication, your strategic prioritization is an entirely different motion than your standard like A3, A5, which is our operations and kind of strategic planning, future warfighting type activities to generate requirements. That process breaks down when you have to go to every single stakeholder and say, okay, weather, what do you need for cloud computing? Okay, logistics, what do you need for cloud computing? Okay, intelligence, what do you need for cloud computing? And so it's a different motion altogether. And so the first vision is to continue to reform and optimize enterprise IT delivery to better align to that commoditization motion, because that is going to, over time, continue to simplify what's happening at the edge or the pointy end of the spear. And you see this through a lot of our existing IT efforts. So our enterprise IT as a service, or what we call ITAS, we're doing things like centralizing help desks. We're doing things like transforming the way that we do local IT support for networking. Those things are key, largely because those platforms are getting more and more sophisticated over time, but also because when we look at the sort of national strategic military space, we want our airmen and guardians doing airmen and guardian specific things as much as possible and not commodity IT elements. Those are things that could be even under warfighting constructs transition to contractors who are supporting it centrally and in an automated fashion with the deep institutional knowledge to make those things work. So we have to automate, we have to have these richer services, and we have to continue to find clever ways to enable the edge to consume those services. And so what this means from, that's the sort of 50,000 foot view. In the 30,000 foot view, we've identified real key enablers that we think are important to get that done, right? And to begin the process of that modernization. And so we have things like our identity foundations. As we move towards richer identity, it's going to be the foundation for zero trust architectures. But getting people into modern identity constructs is a change both technically for underlying systems, but also kind of a change to business processes. And so building those service constructs for how we would enable, for instance, instead of you signing up with every single mission application, you would have a centralized place where you go and get access for things to do your job. And then eventually you're just automatically granted access for things to do your job. To get there requires us to change all of the business processes for how you sign up for those websites. That is digital transformation. It is the core of what digital transformation actually is. But for us to get that service out, there are, you know, 30 intermediate milestones for how you, you know, deliver the centralized product, how you onboard groups of customers, how you message to people about what they need to do to come on board to this. There's a lot of that service marketing even for what the future of that core piece of identity even looks like. So we have broken it down again to these like kind of core enablers that have all of this depth and all of these kind of intermediate milestones that we're trying to get people to conceptualize, to understand, and to be able to work through. So identity is really important to us. Cloud computing is really important to us. The next generation of access based around zero trust principles is really important to us, but you can think of it largely as eliminating the need for VPNs. There are also kind of the next generation of connectivity. So if you think of Maslow's hierarchy of technology, right, at the bottom, the first thing is resilient connectivity, right? If you can't get to your data, or you can't get to the compute platform where you have everything hosted, nothing else matters, right? And I'm not just like pandering to the classic comms community. Like, it really is truly that important. And so for us, trying to figure out with our ABMS brethren and our enterprise brethren what the future of connectivity resilience looks like, and what that means from, you know, commercial LEO, what that means for, you know, host nation partner connectivity, what that means for cellular and 5G, how all of these new or new-ish things come into play so that we can describe a future and then work backwards from that future to get those milestones knocked out, are really key. So we also have AI and a broad push for automation broadly under, you know, you can think of AI as being of marketing and fancy buzzword over a whole umbrella of automated processes and other digital transformation and digital workforce enablement. So those are the broad pieces of it. But going back to that centralized message of, we need to homogenize what we are doing. We need to reduce the, so there's this principle in cloud where the cloud is about providing these microservices and providing this shared set of responsibilities to its consumers, where the end goal is you only really need to deliver and provide the things that are most unique to your application. And we want to take that and have a similar approach to enterprise services for what we deliver in the department. And so that means, you know, I don't want people doing their own identity. I don't want people doing their own log management. I don't want people doing their own access management. I want people doing their own non-person entity credentialing, right? There are all these little topics that are difficult to do today. And we want to shrink what each individual mission set, right? Each of our individual IT consumers and providers are responsible for. And there are thousands in the Air Force. We want to shrink that to the smallest kernel necessary. And that will help us drive security, drive good cost control, drive easier training because you have less variation. And over time, help make the digital transformation of the military a lot more simple. So there are so many elements there to getting it right. And we are just trying to chip away at those big block services to get that right.
I'd like to combine my next two questions if I could, because I think you alluded to some of the drivers, internal and otherwise, that have shaped and informed the way you're approaching this. But, you know, with that as the backdrop, I'm wondering, Ajay, and you may have touched on this a little bit, but what are some of the core challenges being faced by DAF as respects the enterprise concept and unifying multiple disparate efforts operating at different levels? How do you do that? What are some of the challenges to doing it?
So you can think of DAF IT delivery as being in a chain, and you have to have the right vision for what IT needs to be in terms of its contextualization for the consumer. So when you look at IT, is not a thing that a centralized department delivers, right? As much as we are continuing to empower the CIO and continuing to help drive good policy decisions and drive accountability for IT spend, the reality is you can just buy something and put it into the field, right? And people have operational authority to buy IT. IT is a commodity good, And we don't often think about it as being kind of its own separate thing. IT is embedded in every weapon system that we have. IT is embedded in every, you know, every like mission set from people all the way up to, you know, very, very high end things. And so, but when you look at organizations and, you know, MAGCOMs and forward looking, forward deployed folks, those folks are very good at two pieces of the IT delivery chain, which is product market fit and time to delivery. Meaning if they have money and they know what they need, they can go out and buy a thing that they need, right? And this is great for innovation, right? This is great for being able to say, I've got a problem. I've got some brilliant, scrappy airmen and guardians. We are going to duct tape together a solution. It's going to meet our needs. And we've seen some incredible innovations come out of it. We've seen incredible advances in kind of the hybrid cloud elements coming out of really both of our PACAF, which is our Pacific Theater, and USAFE, which is, you know, Air Force in Europe. Both of them have geographic and logistic and IT data movement challenges based upon the fact that we operate in other, you know, foreign nations, and we operate in challenging geography. So they've developed solutions for connectivity and for computing and for their kind of sub-enterprise view that really meets their needs. The trick then is I need to be able to take those things that are working really well, things that have proven themselves as being a good demonstration of what the edge needs, and then find a way to commoditize that back into the center so that we can eventually sustain those efforts. And so this is a lot of promotion. It's a lot of understanding about why they've made the technical choices they've made. It's a lot of helping to deconflict different priorities. So the center is cost control and scale. And that is a key framing of the value that each part provides, and that helps to really streamline the conversation. And so that's sort of one link in the chain. And then I've got a further link behind me where we're talking to the broader DoD. And if you look at DoD CIO and you look at what the Navy and the Army is doing, we share similar challenges and we share similar just similar structural issues with the way like CIOs are organized and the way, you know, Title 50 intelligence versus Title 10 military have to interact, and they have different authorities, you know, responding to different parts of the government. And we have these sort of problems. Like we want to make sure, for instance, that and even some really basic stuff, we want to be able to share calendars between the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. And you'd think that that is, you think like, oh, just share a calendar. It's not that easy. And it's taken us a long time to really get that right. So there are these coordination challenges, especially when you get to the COCOM world, where all of your individual services need to present forces and present systems to the COCOM so they can go out and fight the fight. And we're not quite in sync, and it makes it difficult for COCOMs to be able to get the systems that we need. So we need to make sure that we're staying in line with what the broader DoD and these broader DoD entities look like under OSD. But if we at the center of the Air Force have a hard time truly understanding the product market fit, OSD is one other link in the chain removed from that. And so trying to unify that messaging so that we deliver these whole of nation, whole of department capabilities that meet the needs of folks who are out in the field, setting up wiring and doing communications, that's very challenging and requires such a broad view of IT is one of the kind of core challenges. Additionally, when you look at various products that are out in the market, this challenge is really similar to a lot of the spaces where you would see companies that have acquired a lot of other companies, and you have all these sort of like pockets of IT that are not pre-integrated. For instance, like if I were to choose a zero trust product right off the shelf, right, I would choose, you know, there are a number of vendors in this space. But if I choose vendor A and the Navy chooses vendor B, vendor A for access and vendor B for access don't interoperate. And so we have this natural enterprise of enterprises problem that requires coordination and pressure on the industry to come together in a way that we haven't resolved yet. And as we get closer to trying to modernize on certain approaches for things, if we look at in particular cloud architecture, there's some art for how you get there. Things like SD-WAN, So software-defined wide area networking and zero trust, either software-defined perimeter or secure access service edge. Those are not compatible with each other at all. And different products don't have a clean way to interoperate. And so we are struggling as either a collective action, winner-take-all type of a vendor approach, or some kind of open standard interoperability. And the industry for a lot of these things isn't to the point where there is a commoditized industry standard solution for things. And because of where we're at in that arc of maturity, we're not going to be there for quite some time. So we're going to be making these vendor decisions and then having to figure out interoperability and kind of cross-pollination later. And it's a huge challenge because it requires such intimacy with the products you pick.
Yeah, and it's a great segue into some of the things you talked about, which is the narrative building, the ability to communicate it. And you just mentioned in your response, zero trust. So I was wondering if you can transition a little bit to the development, release, and progress to date of the Air Force's zero trust roadmap strategy. And one thing, you may have already said this, Jay, but why did you choose a roadmap approach to building this out, this strategy out? And what can you tell us about the process you employed in developing the zero trust strategy and roadmap?
So when I came into this job, we were sort of tasked with figuring out the what, right? So the Pentagon is quite good at the how, right? There's a machine that does all the budgetary stuff, and there's a machine that does a lot of the policy stuff. But the place where I've been really asked to focus is on the what, right? We know how to do something once we decide what it is we're going to do. And so if I look at, you know, take a look at the space, and I had a fair amount of familiarity because I worked with the Air Force for probably 3 or 4 years as a pretty close outsider. It was clear that there was not a broad plan. Zero trust breaks the military in such an interesting way, because zero trust is not a product that you can stick in a PEO and just have the PEO. Program executive officer. So it's a high ranking military official who's in charge of a set of deliverables for a set of requirements. And you can't say, okay, we're just going to go buy zero trust. Instead, zero trust is this architectural imperative that touches hundreds of thousands of things, whether or not it's the endpoint to the network to, like, what are you going to do about printers? What are you going to do about medical devices? What are you going to do about fire life safety, right? What are you going to do about each individual application? What are you going to do about your data platforms? So it has these broad implications for everything, and it requires us to express an architectural opinion over the, you know, 30 or so disparate programs that are delivering enterprise IT and then all of their consumers. And so the roadmap, the concept to say, okay, we're just going to have to figure out where we're going, what our story is for all of these things that DoD is trying to tell us to do. But also, you know, when we say zero trust we want a zero trust architecture, that is going to mean something different for Cloud One, that is going to mean something different for Platform One, that is going to mean something different for Office 365, that is going to mean something different for the endpoint, that is going to mean something different for each of those different platforms. And we had to really contextualize it, break it down, and figure out what we're going to be able to get at. And we had told people for so long that zero trust was important that there were all these pilots going on, and there's still all these pilots going on for people who are trying all these different things, right? So Sustainment Center is doing one thing, and our nuclear enterprise is doing another thing. And how do all of these come together into a consistent end state where we can then understand the programmatic milestones to get there? And so we started off on this kind of just get our act together thing that became the roadmap. But what also started to be clear is, as we look across the chain of IT delivery for the department, if you look left and say, you know, the place where things are supposed to start are kind of in a strategy, and then they work their way through the POM process, which is how we get our budget, and we go all the way through this, and we get to delivery where you have like a concept of operations and then acquisition documents. It was clear that two things were busted. First off, we were not always delivering. We didn't have a strategy written down for everything. So our institutional knowledge baseline was really pretty uneven. And then the delivery for execution meant that there were all of these interim homework steps that we just weren't tracking as an integrated part of delivery. And so it was key for us to kind of write those down and do the milestone tracking. And that's been one of the most illustrative things for us. So we keep all of our milestones, these intermediate milestones for the plan that we have developed over for zero trust, for now, for zero trust ICAM and networks. And we're working towards API and data access as the fourth one. But we're managing each of these milestones, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of intermediate milestones. And we are endeavoring to update them every single quarter. And what this does is it keeps us accountable to progress. We try and do so publicly so people can see our current thinking, people can understand how we have broken things up and how we've talked about them. But then how we're able to get people who don't feel like they are in the path, the critical path of delivery, to be able to do the homework and do the intermediate milestones to be able to deliver things on time. And that level of kind of whole of community delivery management, it's still nascent. It's going a lot better now that we're about a year into it, where we are working through the homework, but getting people to prioritize and focus on those things has been kind of one of the transformative things that we've worked on over the last couple of years. And the Zero Trust FMO under ACC are the folks who are really the tip of the spear for management of those things, as well as reporting up and down to DoD CIO. So it's been a huge, like, I like to think of the road mapping process as the digital transformation of the IT delivery ecosystem, because it forces you to focus and digitally track intermediate milestones in a way that provides leadership the data about how delivery is actually going. And like, even just writing down week by week, saying like, yeah, no progress is made because we're blocked on this, no progress is made because we're blocked on that, even gathering that data about the delivery ecosystem has been illustrative about what's actually going on. And so it's been huge for us.
It's got to be revelatory for all the stuff that you're seeing.
Not in the best way. It's revelatory, but it's not always the best.
But it may be in a way to spin it in a positive way. At least now you know what the roadblocks are. If you didn't have this exercise, you'd be like, well, why is this happening?
And this is key for the Pentagon, right? The Pentagon does exist in a bubble, right? Where they don't always get a lot of outside inputs from the field, or if they do, it's for this very curated brief. And so having the data that you can't argue with about where the holdup is, it's easy when you're in that bubble to form kind of these gut feeling narratives about why things aren't going well, right? Because you have limited data coming in, and you're trying to make a decision. And leaders want to be able to pull the levers of power to speed up delivery, but they're not always given the opportunity and the understanding to do the right thing, right? Is it money? Is it advocacy? Is it policy? Is it prioritization? Right? All of these things the Pentagon can meaningfully provide, but without that data input, you're guessing. And that's been a huge thing, that trying to get people to focus in on the data residuals from delivery is so huge.
How is the U.S. Air Force leveraging emerging technologies such as AI to transform how it does IT? We'll explore this question and so much more when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.
How does an agency decide upon and implement a performance management framework that will be successful for their specific administration? The IBM Center report, A Practitioner's Framework for Measuring Results, follows the implementation and results of the CSTAT management framework in Colorado's Department of Homeland Security in hopes that it can guide others who may want to institute a similar approach. Download A Practitioner's Framework for Measuring Results by Melissa Wavelet on businessofgovernment.org today. Agile methodology has allowed for agencies to keep up with the growing demands for fast response to problem solving. The Opportunity Project, TOP, serves as a catalyst in adapting agile techniques to solve complex agency mission problems. TOP works with federal agencies to identify challenges and facilitate iterative approaches in response. In the IBM Center report, Agile Problem Solving in Government, Joel Gurin and Katerina Ribello discuss the factors of success involved in TOP. Download your free copy today at businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jay Bonci, Chief Technology Officer within the U.S. Department of the Air Force. I want to skip ahead to the ICAM and the Identity, Credential, and Access Management area. And given that you've said, and it's noted that it's nested into Zero Trust, I was interested to know, why did you decide to split it out and focus on it distinctly? And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what's going on in this roadmap.
Yeah, so Zero Trust is... you could put everything under zero trust if you wanted to. And so because it's an architectural imperative, so we did this for a couple of reasons, right? So when we create roadmap artifacts, we try and optimize the visual simplicity, right? We want them to be a dashboard and visual about how things are coming together or what's next or what you can think about for the next quarters or the next, you know, probably about six quarters of future projection. And so, you know, you could, anything that's important touches zero trust. And so you could put everything in a zero trust roadmap. It is key to be able to understand why identity is such an important pillar for zero trust going forward. But in this case, we thought, okay, there's enough detail here to be able to pull that out. And actually, I think each of the roadmaps that we are doing in the future, so network should nest inside the zero trust roadmap as like a broader network roadmap. The application level one, where we really think about what's going on with applications and the API work that we have coming up, that should nest under the application level workload. So we're trying to get kind of cute and do that kind of visual mapping. And for two reasons, it allows you to say zero trust is important and all of this stuff is in support of zero trust. So one of the things that I'm mainly concerned with as we go through zero trust is that zero trust is like a 15-year journey. And the messaging fatigue on this is bananas, right? Leadership is going to change out every 2 years. And we have this sort of ship of Theseus problem where, you know, the people who are in the middle of the journey won't have seen the beginning and they won't see the end. And so being able to talk about, to say like, yes, zero trust is still important. We don't say zero trust as much as we used to, but it is a part of what we're delivering. And to show the linkages between these different areas, I think is key. So working within that framework for us for messaging has been incredibly important.
I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned a couple of times the API, the application programming interface strategy, and how you're using that to really try to enable real-time authoritative data sharing on a global scale. Can you tell us more about what this means for the Air Force?
Yeah, so APIs, application programming interfaces, are really, really, really important and kind of subtly so. So when we look at the regulatory framework around what happens inside of DoD, there is so much effort placed around person entities, right? I have a common access card sitting here in front of me, plugged into my computer, that identifies who I am, and it is the core of DoD identity. We have forced everyone onto the standard. It has warped the way that industry, you know, all major vendors have support for it now, and it is such an important part of our credentialing ecosystem. But where the places where we don't have what's next are what's going to happen with our non-person entities. And so how does a software role interoperate with something? How do we share data between systems? And this is incredibly important in that enterprise of enterprises world. You've probably heard something about JADC2 or CJADC2, which is the coalition to join all domain something or other. And the goal there is to say, okay, we have all these disparate DoD systems and they need to compose into one single picture so that we have this common command and control vision. And what happens is you have this Conway's Law problem where different organizations who don't talk to each other don't arrive on any type of standard just because that communication in the bureaucracy is incredibly difficult. So the way that we've chosen to solve this is by drilling down very, very deeply and to say, okay, we're going to have an API strategy. And this is going to express itself coming out in April, as soon as we get through GC and PA review, to say, okay, we're going to publish a draft API reference architecture that's going to talk about the enterprise services and the enterprise standards that we're going to narrow in on. And we're going to get commentary from our sister services and from industry to understand what's supportable. This is us deploying, again, to the strong enterprise services point, strong enterprise services to govern credentialing and message traffic management to get to a single SDK that enables DAF-to-DAF communications. And what that does is it clarifies for us our non-person entity requirements inside of ICAM, and it clarifies for us how we can communicate between these large data platforms in a way that is independent of the underlying data storage or structuring layer so that we are less tied into these ecosystems. It also moves us from a data fabric ecosystem where we have these large ETL platforms, so extract, transform, load, where we suck a bunch of data out of its canonical source, clean it up, and then we have access to it, and move it more towards a direct data access model, which is A, going to reduce costs, you know, is at least going to stand on the growth curve of cost for data access, but then it's going to provide us a consistent and unified vision between being able to access individual data objects and software control interfaces in the same manner. And that's going to allow us to apply consistent cybersecurity at that application and message exchange layer. And it's also going to allow us to provide the scaling primitives that you would see applied to any, the same way that any large cloud provider would do that today. So, you know, if you look at the, you know, Amazons or Microsofts of the world, they have to do all of their IAM and scaling work to make it so that they can handle the volume of API and messaging traffic for their backend. And what that does is it simplifies the experience for those people who are providing data and software endpoints. Again, to kind of the previous point, we want to make it so that it's easy to provide services, that everything is structured, and then applications only need to worry about their particular unique piece of functionality in this kind of dApp-specific shared responsibility model. So that first step is to get that reference architecture out, explain everything I just said. This is the goals. This is when we, how we intend to use it. These are the communities that we want to have. We want to make sure that it exists the same at every classification level. And then work through with the industry to say, hey, you know, not every corporation provides their own IAM solution, right? We're sort of unique in that sense. So hey, industry, what do you have for IAM solutions, right? What is best practice for API protection and API scaling? Like, what are the things that we need to think through? So that's the conversation that we're going to start here next month. We're really looking forward to it. We have some upcoming engagements, some upcoming public engagements in May, where we're going to be doing kind of a deep dive. But it's going to be an opportunity for us to get feedback. You know, the early feedback we've gotten kind of from friends and family is, no, this is necessary. We're on the right track, which is good, right? We don't want to come up with something that's that shows how out of touch we are. But we do want to have that strategic discussion about what products enable this. What are other major, you know, what are the Walmarts of the world doing? What are the Targets of the world doing? How are they solving these types of large scale organizational consumer provider relationship management problems that large API deployments solve? So again, it's about making the Air Force a lot smaller, but it is both the macro to the micro of what's next.
Jay, before I let you go, I was hoping I'd be remiss in not asking you about cloud and AI and what's going on in those areas. Could you give us maybe a high level overview of what's happening with the cloud journey and maybe what you're doing around AI?
Sure. So the cloud journey for us is something that we're going to need to accelerate. So we're kind of thinking about this as, you know, what is our next generation of cloud adoption look like? So we have about 100, 110 elements inside of Cloud One. We have another set of kind of intelligence users who are in intelligence clouds. But those are the folks who are ready and willing to go. And so now that we are in kind of that second tier of folks who want to go to the cloud, the messaging is going to be shifting. So we have an upcoming cloud strategy that will be coming out that talks a little bit about the shift away from cloud as being a cost driver. So you've heard from a lot of folks like, oh, we're going to close down data centers, right? You know, we're going to kind of consolidate into commercial cloud and commercial best practices. And all that is still true. But the reason to do that is not for cost reasons, right? You can make a very, not very feature-filled data center very cheaply. And so cloud is about resilience. And to change the messaging about how you embrace commercial cloud best practices for resilience, and then you can get cost control and scalability along the way. So that core change of messaging, and then how we drive the enablement for applications that are either not super well funded or not super technically ready or kind of have an uncertain cloud future. How do we better create cloud guardrails and the pathway to the cloud in a way that makes that easier? That is the focus of the next cloud strategy as it comes through. And so we're going through internal cord on that now. At this point, we're probably going to expect it. Hopefully, it'll be public by the end of April. And then AI as well is an incredibly hot topic. You know, the world had a lot of fun with ChatGPT over the last year as we all just got acquainted with the with that whole set of technologies. AI is incredibly important to a number of things that we're delivering, whether or not it is inside of our core enterprise IT, inside of our knowledge work, inside of all of our data processing elements. It is a part of technical and organizational maturity to get there. And so we are trying to build those guardrails around how folks can adopt AI. So we've taken this huge push towards the ethical AI frameworks so that people can make the right decisions about how they consume AI products. Because AI is going to be built into everything. Again, it's an architectural imperative. It's not a thing you buy by itself anymore. And so how do we understand that we as the Department of Defense are driving ethical AI outcomes to make sure that they aren't biased, that they have appropriate consideration for automation? So human in the loop or on the loop to be able to understandable, explainable, all of these qualities of AI. So we're building those frameworks. We have a lot of strong AI deployments today in a huge number of our systems. We are continuing to drive investment in those areas. And then we also want to make sure that we are meeting the demand, as we sort of talk about, ChatGPT, but there is a huge amount of automation of knowledge work that those types of platforms can enable. So trying to make sure that we have the right kind of GPT-ish guardrails around generative AI and its ability to, again, transmit ideas and information very quickly through an organization. We need to be able to embrace that and to be able to meet the demand of our force so that, if we aren't meeting demand for the tools that the enterprise should be providing, whether or not it's collaboration, whether or not it's, AI or generative AI, or whether or not it's, voice or even workable cloud guardrails, then things leak out of the enterprise. And we have this give and take between reality and kind of hard governance where we have to kind of meet the field where they're at. So we're working very diligently to get those right guardrails out and working with ARFRL and a couple of other entities to pull together what we think right looks like. So more to come there, but it's going to be a huge part of everything that we do, as well as, cleaning up technical debt and making sure we have the right budgetary and people structure. So there's never short of things to do.
I would like to ask you one last question, if you don't mind. What advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service?
Working in public sector has been an amazing experience. You get to work with people who are dedicated and passionate about helping out each other and helping out the nation. And it's been incredibly personally rewarding to doing that. It is challenging. If you have the opportunity, if the opportunity presents itself, really seriously consider it, even if it is, like myself, I'll probably be back up in industry at some point and joke that I'm a rental for the government. But, go be a rental. It gives you such an appreciation, not only as a citizen, but as a technologist, about how large organizations do anything. And if you can understand the culture and you understand the frustration and the incentives of all of these different groups within this, it makes you such a much more effective technologist and a much more effective communicator for how to move even smaller organizations forward. I have learned the lessons I came in to learn and then some, and it's been a really good experience. I would encourage that. There are lots and lots of ways to get involved here in public sector, whether or not it's on the FedCiv side, whether or not it's with the military or a lot of other similarly aligned organizations. And so talk to folks who've been in, come and kind of join the conferences, understand what the community is thinking. And it's been great. I've made a lot of lifelong friends here, so I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, Jay, thanks so much. I have a lot more questions, so I'm going to invite you back. But I want to thank you for your time today. But more importantly, Jay, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Hey, it's been an honor here to support those in uniform and those who serve. So thank you for having me on, Michael. It's been great.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Jason Bonci, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of the Air Force. Be sure to join us next time for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government leadership and its effectiveness. Until then, subscribe, download, and listen to the entire interview at iTunes, Spotify, Audible, or on your favorite podcast app, and as always at businessofgovernment.org. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
How can government best use big data to transform decision-making, public services delivery, and communication? The IBM Center Report, Integrating Big Data and Thick Data to Transform Public Services Delivery, by Yanyan Ang, presents 5 recommendations for public managers introducing the concept of mixed analytics, urging thick data, meaning qualitative information about users, to be presented alongside big data to improve government decision-making. Visit businessofgovernment.org to read more.